Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go.
Is it playing?
You can't hear it?
No.
Hang on. Yeah, it's playing. Yeah, it should be going out.
I can't hear.
All right, hang on.
Well, you have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwineBTR. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwineBTR. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
All right. Thank
All
you,
right.
Not,
right.
Not raining this evening like they predicted yet anyway, so the bus people are happy. We have a guest tonight. I think he's on here. The phone number is muted. But we have a guest tonight.
Yeah.
A return guest, Stephen Lane. He is an author. He was on, I don't know how long ago, but we had a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking with him. And then he wrote another book. And this time, Jupiter's Blood, I read it and it was fantastic. He is really a great writer. And he's with us again tonight to be able to talk some more about the book. He's in the green room now, filling himself up on all the food we have in there and all the drinks. So we're going to have to have him put everything down and swallow so he can come out and talk to us about his new book. So I guess that's him. So welcome to the show, Stephen.
Hi, Ron. Great to speak with you again. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Glad to have you back with us. So you are, you are a author. You know that you have written your second book.
This is actually the third wine novel. So I have Root Cause, Dragon Vine, and now Jupiter's Blood. This is the second one that we've talked about.
Okay, Root Cause. I haven't read that yet. Same.
Oh, you must. It's my first wine thriller based on Phylloxera.
Oh, really? Oh. Well, I'll have to get that.
That was a lot of fun.
What is the name of it? Let me write that down.
So it's Root Cause. It's about it's about phylloxera and what if a mutated version of phylloxera came back and attacked the world's vineyards.
Oh. And we didn't have American rootstock to save it.
Exactly. Yeah, because that's still a very real threat. If phylloxera did mutate in such a way that it could attack American rootstock, the world's vineyards would be in a lot of trouble.
They would be in serious trouble, yeah. What could you do? You'd have to pulling everything out, but that really wouldn't do any good because the nematodes would still be in the soil. And
exactly, yes. Yeah, so we'd really be in a lot of trouble. So I like to think of the worst case scenarios for the wine industry, and that's where my novel ideas come from.
Yeah, well.
I'm a bit of a fatalist.
Yeah, I see that. Root Cause, so I'll have to get that ordered and read that, because that sounds interesting. I enjoy your books anyway, both of them that I've read.
You.
Really interesting. So, Jupiter's Blood. Give us a synopsis of that for the readers or for the listeners.
Yeah. So, in an equally fatalistic approach, I thought, what if a synthetic wine could be developed that could imitate and then match the best wines out there? What if a wine could be faked in a lab or created in a lab that could pass for the best Premier Cru, Grand Cru wines in the world? And what would that look like? What would happen? How would that happen? And I mean, just imagine if you could make bulk wine in such a cheap fashion that matched the best wines in the world. What would that do to the industry? What would that do to people in the industry? So that's where the idea came from. And I was talking to a winemaker from Burgundy at a wine dinner in Singapore, of all places. And that's where the idea came from, because we can pretty much fake and synthesize anything and everything these days, whether it's Beyond Meat or Impossible Foods or Finless Fins or Omnipork. I mean, anything you want, you can create in terms of smell, touch, taste, and why not wine? Because wine, when it comes down to it, is a very basic chemical composition of water, of phenolics, acids, sugars. You can break it down and determine what's in a wine, so why can't you determine what's in a wine and then build it back up using those basic components? And some companies are already out there doing that and trying to do that. So it's only a matter of time. I don't think it's a matter of if, it's a matter of when that becomes a reality.
How would the general public react to something like that? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, we already drink a lot of fizzy drinks that are mostly chemicals.
that's a good point. Getting away from the wine, just going to all the other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, truffle oil is pretty much synthetic. I mean, a lot of the food we eat is processed. Fake fur exists. You have a lot of these, like Impossible Meat and Beyond Meat exists already. So I think the public in general would begin to accept it. And that's what the story explores. So on one side, there's a master of wine, Dante Lombardi. He's a master of wine, master sommelier, three Michelin star restaurant owner and operator. So he's on the one side of the argument. Of course, he's totally against it and aghast at the concept. And on the other side, you've got one of the scientists, Vivian, who's helped create it. And throughout the story, they end up getting together in terms of trying to find a scientist. I won't go into too much detail, but they've got to find a scientist who's disappeared with the Vino code. And they have to essentially come to grips with each other's understanding and viewpoints on the subject. And over the course of the story, they both come to understand the other's viewpoint. And so it's a lot of fun to explore both sides of the argument.
Yeah, it was. It was an interesting book. The thing is, you skipped over the fact that they traveled the wine world. And that was, you obviously have been to quite a few places, because you painted a beautiful picture in the book of these places. And what they were like. Oh, you didn't actually. I felt like I was right there.
Well, I've been very blessed. I've been able to travel to quite a few wine regions, and whenever I find a place or find myself in a place, and I just fall in love with it and think how beautiful it is and how much history there is, that really just transports me and inspires me. And I think if it's that inspiring to me, if I can capture and convey that in a chapter or in a story in some way, the reader should enjoy it just as much. And hopefully that does come to be.
And you did an excellent job. I did enjoy it very much. I can just have a mental image of what some of these places were like, not being there. As anyone does, they paint their own picture of it. But you did a very good job of it.
Thank you.
Again, you deserve the credit, and you're quite welcome. Well,
and it's interesting because it's trying to find a balance as well, because I don't want to over-explain a region or a scene. I do want to paint a vivid picture, but I also want to leave it in the reader's imagination to an extent. I mean, a lot of readers, if I mention the vineyards of Burgundy, people who know their wines will instantly have a picture of what the vineyards of Burgundy look like with the walls around them and the gentle slopes going up the Côte d'Or. But some people who don't know the wine industry need a bit more of a picture painted for them. So I try to find a balance between those who know wines and the wine world and those who don't, and leaving a lot to the imagination as well.
I think most people have seen pictures of vineyards in different areas, though. And so when you mentioned Napa or you mentioned Burgundy, I think people recall a picture that they've seen, whether they're into wine or not, because they're all over the place. I mean, the pictures of vineyards.
And that's the hard part too, because I think a lot of people are, I mean, people are so educated these days. I mean, if you're a sommelier, for instance, there's so many people, restaurant customers who know their wines, who have their own collections, who have traveled the world and have eaten in great restaurants. So, and similarly, readers are really educated these days. They're very knowledgeable. So you've really, I have to be very careful how I write. I need to make sure I get everything really accurate, and that, so that I don't mislead people and they don't think, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. So I'm very, very careful in what I write, and I do a lot of research. I take a lot of pictures when I travel. I'm writing another book right now called Heist Bordeaux. That's the working title. And I was just recently in Bordeaux for a week, and I just spent the week traveling around Bordeaux and looking, taking pictures of the city and marking down the streets that things would happen on. Because, yeah, you've got to be very accurate these days when you're writing or putting together a screenplay or anything people are going to absorb and look at.
Well, and like you say, people are more well-traveled now, too. The Earth is really smaller than it used to be because of the ability
Absolutely.
To jump on a jet and be in Europe in no time and stuff like that.
Or jump online and look at pictures and look at videos. So it's really – everything's very accessible, which is great. I mean, overall, it's a great thing.
Yeah, that's – I didn't consider online, but that's true, too. You punch in there, show me pictures of Burgundy, and there you've got yourself, pages and pages of them. It's
And that's one of the other themes I was looking at in the story. I mean, just as we think about, online, you look at social media, you look at the internet. It's an overall very positive thing, but if you look at election interference or bullying online, people can point to the internet and social media and say it's very negative too. And I think synthetic wine could have a similar perception for a lot of people. Some people might think it's a great idea. It's a great way to introduce people to wines. It's a gateway wine. It can help reduce the impact of climate change. But then some people who are purists, like Dante in the story, he would say, oh, no, it's terrible. We can't do that. We've got to focus on pure wine. The natural wine movement is much more important than any kind of chemical interference. So that was one of the big themes of the story, too. Synthetic wine in itself isn't inherently good or evil. It's a tool. It's a product. And how we use it or how we interact with it determines its moral value.
Well, you say it's a gateway. I've always considered Boone's Farm and Thunderbird as gateway wines.
I mean, these critter labels from Australia, I mean, people criticize them. But at the same time, if it gets people who aren't really into wine and enjoying wine to begin with, then one would hope that their palates would evolve and develop and they'll start to appreciate better and bigger wines eventually.
And I think that's so true because so many people like sweet wines. In fact, my granddaughter is a wine fan, but it's sweet wines.
Yeah.
And I keep telling her, I said, one day you're going to be drinking drier wine. No, I won't. I like sweet wines. And I really think that eventually
Absolutely.
She's going to
our palates evolve.
Yeah. And she'll start looking for something that's a little bit drier and all that. Yeah. So.
You criticize a good white Zin, but a good white Zinfandel can be beautiful. And when it comes down to it, it can be quite nice as a port pounder or something you drink on a terrace in the summertime. And as you say, eventually people will grow into more sophisticated wines, drier wines.
Yeah, and I think it's just about any type of wine can be a gateway wine as long as it's whoa, wait a minute. Something just jumped in. I was
just approachable.
Boris and something jumped in there. Sorry about that. We had a guest on Beauvais from Beauvais Winery who did nothing but rosés. So when you talk about rosés being gateway wines, that's what the winery does. And so.
Yeah, I mean, rosés are so versatile, too. I mean, they're great aperitifs, they're great with food as well. I mean, whether you're having a salmon or duck dish or something, or partridge or pigeon, I mean, they just go with anything, really. So they're great wines, rosé wines. I think, they're very underrated.
I believe so, too. He says he makes dry rosé wines. And I think the general perception of rosés tend to be, like a white Zin or stuff like that, tend to be a little bit sweeter, and people start making dry rosés. I think it's along the same line as Rieslings. People tend to think of Rieslings as sweet.
Absolutely. Yeah, but then you get a beautiful Riesling from Clare Valley or something, you think, wow, this is great.
Yes, exactly. There's some nice dry ones coming out of Virginia and New York State, too.
Well, I tell you, Virginia seems to be getting a lot of attention. I'm currently doing the WSET diploma, and the next every year there's two assignments given to different cohorts of the WSET diploma, and the next cohort needs to write an essay. That's the assignment for their essay assignment, to write an essay on Virginia wines. So obviously, there's obviously a bit of a resurgence there, and a lot more focus on what's happening in Virginia, because Virginia's got a great long history of winemaking. There's a lot of vineyards out there. I lived in Arlington for a couple of years and managed to get to a few vineyards, and they're really well set up for tourism. You go out there and have a great dinner or lunch, and they've got picnic tables outside, and you just sit there and drink their wines. And yeah, there's some nice wines from Virginia.
I was talking about Virginia wines. I get a couple of different emails periodically from the monthly from the Virginia, what is it, Virginia Grapevine Association or something like that. And they're always talking about Virginia wines and the wineries there and what they're doing and all that. But the number of acres in Virginia is just amazing. I mean, for the size of the state, you're thinking that no, that's not going to be much, but there's a lot of acreage under
quite a lot going on. Virginia's been making wine since the time of Thomas Jefferson in Monticello. I mean, he brought vines over from France when he was an ambassador in France, and he brought a huge amount of wines over as well. So there's this great history of wine tradition from Thomas Jefferson onwards,
and they've continued to do the quality wines out of there. What did they do to survive through the prohibition? I'm not aware of that.
Well, apparently the church would still make wine for the sacrament. So a lot of vineyards or a lot of wineries, especially in California anyways, were still able to get away and make wine because they were making wine for the church. That's part of my understanding. In Virginia, I'm not sure, to be honest. So I've read a couple books on prohibition, and that's a fascinating period too.
Oh, it was. Oh, yeah. I knew about the sacramental wines that different wineries made. Brotherhood Winery up in New York survived because of the sacramental wines. But Missouri was a big wine state before Prohibition, and they were decimated because of Prohibition. Now they're starting to come back. Virginia, it just dawned on me. All the stuff I'm getting, I don't know how they survived or what they did during Prohibition. I'm just curious. Maybe you knew.
One area I'm not too familiar with, but I mean, there's definitely a lot of history with Prohibition in terms of the impact on the wine industry, and that for sure will end up in one of my stories in the future.
There you go. All you do is just bide my time.
Bootleggers, Al Capone, and all that. There's so much material there. So, like with Dragonvine, the story takes place partly in the present day and partly in the past. I could see something like that happening with a Prohibition type wine story based in the States.
Yeah, there you go. That would be interesting. The Prohibition.
Yeah, there's no shortage of story ideas.
Prohibition in this country was, in the wine aspect of it, was really strange. I think the wineries got by with more than anybody did. But, I don't know.
It really had an impact on, the current situation, too. I mean, there's a great book called The Prohibition Hangover, which is all about how today's current market in terms of beverage sales throughout the states is all impacted because of since Prohibition. And it's had a long effect on how alcohol is sold and produced and retailed.
Kansas, the Prohibition is, and don't quote me on the dates on this, but it wasn't until the 1998 or something like that Kansas officially declared that the Prohibition was over there.
I think it was Newfoundland that finally got off Prohibition in like 1948 or something. But the Volstead Act was in place for a long time, much longer than I think a lot of people realize in certain states and certain provinces up in Canada.
And people don't consider Canada, too. When they think of Prohibition, they think of the United States. But Canada was impacted seriously by that.
Yep, they were seriously impacted as well. So absolutely. So, there's definitely a story there.
there is. There would be an interesting story there. A lot of stuff on that Prohibition. Well, our three-tier system is a direct result of the Prohibition. So
very much so, yeah. But it seems like that's loosening up, and it seems like a lot of places are now able, like a lot of wineries can now sell direct to consumers. I mean, even in Canada, the LCBO and different organizations across in different states are loosening up, so there's a lot more direct to consumer sales, and people can order wine online now. So it is loosening up for the better, I think, for the industry.
Except for the distributors, and they are all crying about the fact that, you know, it needs to go through them.
The monopolies are being destroyed.
Yes, that's what I mean. Believe me, I'm more than happy that it is. It's always been my, I've preached relentlessly on different programs and stuff about the three-tier system and how it is so unfair and all that. But, I'm glad to see it slowly dying now.
Eroding, Oh, and the problem with North America is that it's not like you've got this huge conglomerate of one country. Like, it's not like America is one market and Canada is another market. If you're a winemaker or a distributor in Europe and you want to deal with America, you've got to deal state by state, and in Canada, province by province. So you don't just get into America or get into Canada. You've got to get into every state one at a time. And there's different rules and regulations and hurdles for everyone. And so it's a nightmare for producers around the world to get their wines into the states and into Canada.
And you don't see my head shaking here because it's so true. It's just it's unbelievable. And even across the country, you don't have to go to Europe and try to get the wine here or South America. It's just from one state to the other, trying to get wine distributed in different areas is just a nightmare. Because
it's so illegal to mail it from state to state. It is difficult. So I touch upon that. Actually, I do touch upon that in Jupiter's Blood just a little bit as well. So I find all these subjects just so topical and fascinating. And I think a lot of consumers aren't really necessarily aware of what's happening in the market. So digging into the market and understanding how the market works in terms of wine sales and distribution is just fascinating. And as you say, head shaking.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get back to the synthetic wine. I don't know. When I read the book, I did a lot of, maybe not. Do you think synthetic wine, you said there are people doing it now, but do you think it is possible to match the quality and the all the aspects, the aromas and colors and all that with synthetic wine as there is in some of the classic wines out there?
Well, like a lot of things, I think it's just a matter of degree. I mean, if you look at most major wineries and most big wineries out there, even smaller wineries, most of them have labs inside them. And the labs are measuring and determining what goes into the wine and how long the wine is aged. They calculate what kind of additions go in, what kind of sugar needs to be added to help the fermentation. So there's a lot of work being done on a chemical basis and science basis to improve wines, to make wines. So it's not that far a leap, actually. It's not like every winemaker out there is doing 100% ambient yeast and purely natural winemaking. There's a lot of science and lab involvement in terms of making wines today. So what I'm talking about in terms of synthetic wine, and what some of the companies are already looking at, is just taking that to a further extreme. So it's not like it's at zero now going to 100. It might be at 15, 20, 30% already.
A glass of wine, red or white, has so many minute chemicals in them. I mean, just unbelievable.
But everything is measurable. You can break down a bottle of wine in terms of its exact components. And those components aren't some rare metal found on a different planet. These are all components we can find or make or generate here on Earth. So you can break down a wine and then rebuild it with the exact same components. Now, of course, whatever we create synthetically would be a snapshot of the wine. I don't think anything created synthetically would be sophisticated enough to age like a good Burgundy or a great Bordeaux. So the aging process, I think, would be very difficult to replicate if it's even possible. But to take a snapshot of a wine as it is right now in a bottle, I think that could be generated synthetically in a lab.
Well, you can, the tannins, I mean, that's already being synthetically added to some wines. And
exactly. Yeah, can, in many respects. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you can
yeah,
do
so
that.
It's not something we want to think about, but it's definitely a reality. Just like we don't want to think about all the processing going on to our foods and all the chemicals going into the fields and animals, but this stuff is already happening, and a lot of us have turned a blind eye to what's happening in the industry. And no matter what we think about it, it is happening out there, and it's just going to get more and more. And people, I think, will accept it because a lot of people won't even question it.
And you're right. There's so much being done to processing of everything that and without the processing, though, I think, you know, be it animals or grain or whatever, without the processing, would they be able to meet the demands? And I think that's the reason they have to do it. Is
yeah, and that's where the story comes in. I talk about that, how it's a government-sponsored program because of the – and I talk about the climate change forms a big backdrop to the story. So a lot of the reason that they're doing this is because of climate change to give the vine growers a break and to help the wine industry essentially.
Yeah, and that's one of the factors of the whole thing is climate change, I think, is creating a different type of mindset for a lot of stuff that we do.
Yeah, very much so.
You know, so.
And you can already see the impact when there's already different grapes being permitted in Bordeaux, different grapes, there's a new grape called Voltus being permitted in Champagne, which would be more disease resistant. There's different grapes being permitted in Portugal as well. So yeah, so a lot of countries now who are very, in the EU anyways, who already have very strict regulations about which grapes and which varieties can go into different wines, are starting to relax those standards and introduce new varieties. Like I said, Bordeaux, Champagne, and Portugal, we're already seeing that.
Yeah, these are, the new grapes are more climate friendly, for lack of...
Yeah, exactly. So climate friendly, more disease resistant, more higher yielding. Because the planet is changing, and there's only so much agrable land that can be planted.
Yeah.
So places like British Columbia, for instance, Ontario, more northern climates, I think, are going to benefit from climate change because they'll become more and more suitable for viticulture.
Well, I've read a couple of different places that by 2050, Napa Valley will no longer be the Napa Valley we know. Willamette Valley in Oregon will actually be the new Napa Valley.
Yeah, they're booming right now.
Yeah, it's moving north.
Well, Oregon's doing very well in terms of the Burgundian varieties.
Yeah, and I've also read a couple of things, too, that say places like South Dakota and Michigan, we're going to start seeing a resurgence of good grapes coming out of those areas because of the warming. And so I don't know. The soil
No doubt. I mean, the states, if you look at the states, too, I mean, every state makes wine. I think a lot of people will be surprised that pretty much every single state makes wine to an extent, even Texas, for instance. And some of those states will just benefit from climate change and from relaxed regulations and the change in what's happening in terms of the wine industry. So we're going to see more and more interesting wines coming out of states that were never considered wine-producing regions.
Yeah, and I think so, too. But, yeah, the thing is, we mentioned climate change, and I think the mind immediately goes to warmth. It's, you know, we had the hottest year this year. We're in the top 5 years or in the top 5 months or top 5 days, you know, of heat. But it's not just that. The weather also is affected by the flooding and what the hail storms they've had over in Burgundy and Bordeaux. This is unprecedented. These things like, well...
Yeah, in Italy as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And
it's getting more and more extreme, and that's just going to have an impact on the types of pests that attack the vineyards and the types of chemicals that they use, and the amount of irrigation that's required, because there are a lot of regions, of course, that totally restrict or forbid irrigation, and already we can see that loosening up in different areas. Like in Spain, for instance, that was recently relaxed a number of years ago, where they can now start irrigating because the amount of water that falls in precipitation just isn't there anymore.
Yeah, and you have those drought areas. It's happening. Well, Chile also. They have long term droughts that go on for 3 or 4 years there, And then they get a storm that comes in and dumps more rain on them than they've had in the last 6 years. And it's doesn't stay, doesn't sink in, it runs off and just destroys the ground. I mean, it's just the climate change is not just heat, like I think, you know, we default to in the mind. It's all this other stuff that is devastating.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in Chile, for instance, the northern wine regions are becoming less and less suitable, whereas they're now starting to expand southwards, where it's getting more and more suitable for producing wine. So, yeah, there's definitely changes in terms of what's happening because of climate change around the world. So that does feature largely in the novel, as well as the backdrop and the reason for the synthetic wine. So I try to make as strong a case as possible for why synthetic wine exists and why it would be good, but also a strong argument for why it's not good. And that's what the two main characters are kind of fighting about throughout the story. So I looked at both sides of the argument, which is a lot of fun because I generally would be against it. I'm a traditionalist. I'm a purist. I prefer a properly made wine, not necessarily fully natural wine, but something synthetic out of a can sold at a gas station. I don't think so.
You know, it could get to that.
Regardless of how far synthetic wine goes, I think there will always be a place for beautifully well-made wine from all the traditional regions, the old world, new world as well. So it's like a technology. It's good and bad, and it's just something that we're going to have to adjust to and get used to. But there will always be a place for great, properly made wine too.
Yeah. And
so I don't want to fearmonger too much.
Yeah. Well, I agree. It's just, you know, and the same thing with all the synthetic. You mentioned, you know, the meat and stuff like this. And there's always the people who are the purists, and I have to raise my hand here and say, yes, I'm one of those, who would rather have real meat than the foam meat. And same thing with wine. I'm right in that same school as you on the wine. Although I am not fully educated on, well, even hamburgers, you know, the plant-based hamburgers and stuff, I'm not fully educated on that because I avoid it anyway. So therefore, I can't say, oh, this is really, really good. I should try more of this plant-based meat because I don't try it to begin with. And you think...
Yeah, exactly. And I think synthetic wine would be the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's what I was just going to say. Do you think that would happen with wine? I think you think people would say, oh, no, I'm not going to do this. This is synthetic. You said you research both. How much information is there out there about synthetic wine?
Surprisingly a lot, actually. I said, there's a couple of companies in the States who are already making synthetic wine, synthetic whiskey, synthetic spirits as well. So I explored their websites and got a better sense of what they're doing and how they're doing it. And there's certainly a lot of discussion about it, but it's still a long way from being a product that you're going to see on your shelves in the wine shops or in your specialty retail stores. So it's not something I think we need to worry about too much, but it is very much a possibility. And I tried to be, I wanted to kind of predict the phenomenon long before it became a real thing. Whether it does take off or whether it doesn't, I don't know. But I thought it'd be interesting to look at it while it's still in its nascent form before it really takes off and becomes this big, big discussion.
Yeah, I can see that. It's obviously in its infancy. Yeah, that's why I was curious if there is any information out there on it. But
if you do research, there's definitely information out there. And like I said, with wineries, a lot of them have labs already. And I've worked in two wineries myself. I've visited many, many wineries. And the amount of additions that go into wine or the amount of chemical analysis and processes behind making wine is, I think, a lot more than people would suspect. I mean, if you ask any winemaker to show them their chemical room in the winery, they'll give you a bit of a weird look and not show you what's behind that locked door because they don't want you to see all the tartaric acids and cultured yeast and everything else that goes into making wine, because wine is not just purely grape juice fermenting.
No, it's fermented and manipulated a little bit. Yeah, you know,
there's a lot of manipulation. That's exactly the word. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I had my winery, it was the same thing. There was always stuff I added to it. You know, And simple things like sometimes it was just simply color. You know, grape extracts that give you dark color, and you'd add a little bit to different wines just to bring out that color a little bit more instead of having it.
Yeah, because consumers have a very set idea of what a wine should look like, what it should taste like, what it should feel like. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and so you strive to get to that, and once you get it, you say, okay, this is it. And people don't realize that that happens a lot. It's having pure wine.
Yes, because wine is a natural product, right? It's not going to be exactly the same every year. So there's got to be some amount of manipulation for that product to look the same every single year. And whether it's non-vintage champagne or whether it's a Kendall Jackson Cabernet Sauvignon, if you want it to look the same and taste the same every single year, there's got to be some manipulation.
Yeah, yeah. And, you mentioned Kendall Jackson, too. Kendall Jackson, people love the Chardonnay and stuff like that. And that, the reason they love it, along with others, I'm picking on Kendall Jackson because I'm not a Kendall Jackson Chardonnay fan, but that is manipulated to be the same. So people say, oh, I love the Kendall Jackson Chardonnay. And they pick it up this year and next year and all that. Don't have to worry about looking at the vintage date to see if it's going to change.
It's going to be the same every single year.
Yeah. And, you can't fault Kendall Jackson. It's people buy it because it is the same year after year. And so.
Yeah. And it's not even just Kendall Jackson. I had a good lunch a couple of years ago with, I was Clovis Taittinger. From Taittinger Champagne, and we were having a good chat, and he at one point compared Taittinger Champagne, and this is a member of the Taittinger family, he compared it to Nutella, and we all looked at him askew and thought, what are you talking about? And he said, every single year, it tastes the same. It's created in such a way, the non-vintage house champagne, the house style, is created in such a way that it always tastes like Taittinger house champagne. And he's absolutely right, and same with Nutella. Nutella always tastes the same. You buy it, you know what you're getting. It does what it says on the tin. It's Taittinger House Champagne. It's Nutella. It's Kendall Jackson Chardonnay. And it's what consumers want in general, too. So we can blame the industry. We can blame science. We can blame climate change. But it's us as consumers who are demanding this consistency at the same time.
And that's so true. And you start getting the cheaper wines, and it's even more so that on those than it is the more expensive wines. But it happens on all of them. And
absolutely. Yeah, but as we said, these are gateway wines, hopefully, and eventually people will trade up and develop a more sophisticated palate and enjoy more seasonally variable wines that change vintage by vintage.
Yeah, and once they start realizing.
But as you can see from our discussion, it's such a fascinating subject. There's so much to look at in terms of the wine industry. There's just so many stories to tell as well, which is where I get my ideas from and where Jupiter's Blood came out of in terms of the idea of the story.
Yeah, it is a fascinating story, and again, I enjoyed it tremendously as I was reading through it. It was really,
thank you.
It painted a very vivid picture on a lot of the different things that happened and all that. It was very good. I really did enjoy it. I enjoyed both of them. You know, Dragonvine was.
Yeah, you were Dragonvine previously. The tricky part is, I mean, there's so much I want to put into these books, but I've got to make sure that whatever I'm putting in is relevant. So there's got to be a reason they go to the auction in Burgundy. There's got to be a reason why they're at a wine tasting competition and judging sommelier competition in Italy. So there's got to be reasons behind these. So I try to create the stories in such a way that there's very compelling reasons for these scenes and these scenarios to take place in the book. Otherwise, if anything that doesn't serve the story would not be in there. So there's plenty of other ideas and thoughts and scenarios and anecdotes I'm putting in future books because there's so many things you can write about in terms of the wine industry. So the next book I'm working on, like I said, is the working title is Heist Bordeaux, and it's about the festive wine from one of the bonded wine warehouses in Bordeaux. I mean, these bonded wine warehouses, if you look at them around the world, they hold literally billions of dollars or euros worth of wine. So what a target-rich environment and for a heist.
You can also hit upon the fraud of the wine bottles. The what's not fraud?
Yeah,
what's my,
yeah.
Um,
The counterfeiting?
But no, I'm sorry.
You're talking about the counterfeiting, you mean?
Counterfeiting and fraud? Trying to talk about the counterfeiting.
Yeah, and that's the theme I explore in Jupiter's Blood too. Yeah, the main antagonist is a wine counterfeiter.
Yes.
So that's explored in Jupiter's Blood as well.
Yeah, you hit upon that lightly, but there's so much in that counterfeiting, and you know, I mean, it's a worldwide problem. It's unbelievable.
Oh yeah, I mean, I could write a whole series of books in the wine industry on counterfeiting and just what's going on out there.
Yeah.
There's counterfeit UK or Australian wine here in the UK. We've all heard the stories about there's more counterfeit Lafite in China than there is Lafite in the world. I mean, yeah, it's just, yeah, the sheer amount of counterfeiting is just astronomical.
No, and every time, and they make a big deal out of catching somebody. And it's just like, you know, that's like scraping the top off of it. It's not.
That's a drop in the ocean. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it's not doing a whole lot of good. It just, and they make a big deal out of it, and then that way people are saying, "All right, you're doing your job. You're doing a great job." But it's like you said, it's a drop in the ocean. Yeah,
and it happens not just at the lower levels, but also with Lafite, for instance. But I was at a wine dinner, another different wine dinner in Singapore, and a whole room full of wine people. And all of a sudden, everybody started buzzing because somebody found a counterfeit bottle. There's a vintage bottle going around of a French wine. Sorry?
At the dinner, they found the counterfeit?
At the dinner, yeah. Because a lot of people brought their own wines. And
uh-huh.
It was one of those BYOB wine dinners, essentially. And there was a bottle going around that everybody started looking at. And it turns out, yeah, it was a counterfeit wine. Everybody started looking at the label and realizing there was a misprint on the label. So, because somebody created a fake label and just printed something or misspelled something.
Oh my gosh!
So that's a real threat out there. And even though I explored it a little bit in Jupiter's Blood, I think there's a whole story. Or there's another whole novel that I could write based on counterfeit wine for sure.
Yeah, it's amazing what's going on with counterfeits now. I start looking at different news outlets on wine, and it seems like almost every week there's another incident of some counterfeit wine going on. And it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's such a lucrative trade that it's attractive to a lot of people. And as you say, very few people are caught for it or prosecuted for it. So it's obviously a bit of a risk-free endeavor as well. I mean, if you can make a couple hundred gallons of, or a couple thousand gallons of fake wine and sell it off as vintage Bordeaux or Burgundy or Sassicaia or something, then yeah, it's worthwhile.
You've made a lot of money doing that. Yeah. What do you think about the putting RFD tags in the corks or in the top of the labels? You think that might be a way to, challenge this counterfeiting or help
produce it? Definitely. There's already a lot of technology in wine bottles now, in the capsules. I think I wrote about that in Dragon Vine a little bit, where which company was it? There was one of the famous, I think it was Screaming Eagle or San Quanon, one of the cult Cabernets. They already do some kind of within the capsule itself. There's some kind of code or technology that they can determine which bottle it is, where it was sold. It can determine the provenance, essentially, and it's very unique per bottle. So there definitely is that technology already. And if you look at like some Spanish wines, they have that gold foil cage on it. That's very primitive, of course, but it is a form of wine protection, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And,
So we are going to see more and more of that, I think, in future. Which is good for the consumer. I mean, the more reliable the wines are, the better it is. Because as we say, wine can be made in a lab, and all of a sudden, if you're putting more ethanol in wine than alcohol, you could you start poisoning people. You hear about these stories in third world countries where people make bathtub wine, and all of a sudden, the whole wedding party is blind. It's a real risk that you can be drinking some wine that could have a very detrimental effect on your health if it's made counterfeit. Counterfeit fashion.
I had an article, you mentioned that, and I had an article I found three years ago about bad wine in some country in Asia, the bad wine that was being served, and it really didn't end the story there. It sort of left it up in the air, and I told the listeners. I'll find out the end of this, and I'll let you know. And that was a couple, 3 years ago. I never saw anything else about it. It was just like the story was like it never happened. It just
covered it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was
well, possibly for good reason.
Yeah. Don't want to know.
There's definitely a lot to be said for proper consumer protection and consumer controls to make sure that we are drinking what we believe we're drinking, not only for the sake of not being ripped off, but for the impact on our health as well. I mean, if you're drinking something that has been made in a bathtub in somebody's basement or God knows by some unscrupulous producers who don't care if their end users die, then we can be in a lot of trouble. I mean, look at the drug industry with fentanyl being cut into a lot of street drugs. And that's just had a massive effect on, opioid-related deaths. In what was previously not necessarily a safe environment, but drug use used to be a lot safer than it is now. I mean, anybody who's taking any kind of street drugs now faces a real risk of death with the amount of fentanyl out there and being cut into drugs.
It's amazing. A good point. It's just scary what's happening with that.
Yeah, definitely. It's really terrifying.
Yeah, it is. I just thought of something else while you were saying that, and it slipped my mind because I... what was it? The... talking about the wines and the... I don't know. I lost it.
A million topics to discuss for sure.
yes, it is. Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad you read it and glad that you enjoyed it. And you might have noticed that one of the characters, Vivian, in the book, she was previously a character in Dragonvine. So it's something I'm doing with the wine novels. All the stories take place in the same universe, so to speak. So in Root Cause, there's some characters that appeared in Dragonvine, and Dragonvine, so there's some characters that appeared in Jupiter's Blood. And now in the book I'm writing now, Heist Bordeaux, there's a couple of characters that readers of the first two books will recognize and hopefully like to be reacquainted with. So I'm creating a bit of a universe and overlapping characters, and eventually there might be a story at the end where all the characters get together and have to solve a bigger mystery.
Very good. That's funny you mentioned that about Vivian, because I'm reading this and I'm thinking, wait a minute, she's got the same characteristics, the same as in Jupiter's Blood. And I said, no, that was just, you're just playing with my mind. But you weren't. You were
nope, same character. Yeah, and I even talk about her previous story a little bit, but she's evolved as a character as well. Which if you read Dragonvine first and then Jupiter's Blood, you'll see how she's evolved as a person as well.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Oh, well, that's a good idea. Connecting them all together
it's definitely fun.
Yeah, I can imagine. But then, wow, that would be tough, though, trying to maintain the same type of individual in each of your books as you carry them through, because the situation changes, so therefore it would be a different character. Not really a different character, but a different part of that personality.
Well, I mean, different story for sure, but the good thing about the characters is the further they're developed and the more we see them, the more we can anticipate how they'll react. So, for instance, we know how Dante is going to react because of his background. He's a master of wine, he's a master sommelier, he's a restaurant operator of a 3-Michelin-star restaurant. So you've got a very good idea of how he's going to react to a lot of different scenarios. And similar to Vivian, she's younger, she's more feisty, but she's a scientist. So she'll react in a predictable way based on a scenario because of her background and her character. So it actually gets easier to write about characters when you've got a much better understanding of who they are and how strong they are. Like if you think of any characters out there in stories or TV shows or movies that we watch, the more you know them, the more you know how they're going to react. You think of like a character like Hugh Laurie in House, the TV show about the doctor. You know exactly how he's going to react to different kinds of patients because of the series and how he is. Very acerbic, very, very witty, very sarcastic. And that's just him. So the stronger these characters are, the easier it is to write them in a sense. But the fun thing is eventually having them interact with each other. Like how would Corvina from Root Cause interact with John Haskins in Dragonvine interact with Dante Lombardi in Jupiter's Blood. And because those characters are so strong in their own right, there's definitely a certain amount of conflict that will happen when they get together, regardless of why they get together, which I think is a lot of fun to explore.
Yeah, that sounds, that's great. Names. How do you come up with names? Are these people you've known? Have you just, you open up a phone book and say, okay, I'll call this person this name? What?
But thank you for asking, because I do put a lot of thought into the names, and something that some readers will notice, if you look at somebody like in Root Cause, the main character's name is Corvina Guerra. Corvina, as we know, is a grape used in the production of Amarone in Piemonte in Italy, and Veneto in Italy. And so, but I also looked at the grape, the type of grape, and it's thick-skinned, it's very bold, it's a bit hard to grow, a bit difficult to work with. And I thought, what a cool like character description. And then her last name is Guerra, which is Spanish for war. And her parents are Italian and Spanish, so you got a Spanish grape, you've got a last name that's Spanish, that's Italian. And I just thought, like, what a cool combination. Sorry, last name is Spanish rather. So that's where her name came from. And then in Dragonvine. The main character is Carmine Cooper. Cooper, right. As you know, is somebody who makes barrels. There's a wine connection there. And Carmine is actually an American grape variety.
Oh.
But a lot of people might not realize that. So I just looked at American grape varieties and thought, what's an American grape variety that I could pass off as a guy's name? And I saw Carmine. I thought, oh, that's perfect. So Carmine Cooper is a cool name, too. And then in Jupiter's Blood... Yeah, in Jupiter's Blood. Dante Lombardi, not quite the same. I looked up different characters and the different names. But, yeah, I do a lot of research on it. Like, I look at Ancestry.com or BabyName.com, and I look at names for people who are of a certain background or a certain age. Because you wouldn't call somebody born today Gertrude, for instance. And you wouldn't call somebody who is 80 years old Brad, probably, or Chad.
Right, yeah.
So I do look at the names in a lot of detail. So I do spend a lot of time looking at these names to make sure that they're the right nationality, the right age, appropriate, and I try to tie in the grapes as well. So in my new novel, Heist Bordeaux, the main character, who's the master thief, the George Clooney in Ocean's 11 type character, his first name is Nicholas, and short for Nicholas is Nick, and Nick is a common short form for stealing. If you nick something, right? So it's for stealing, and his last name is Beaunoir, so because he's part French, and Beaunoir is also a grape variety. So it's just, I'd like to have a lot of fun with those kind of things. So I do spend a lot of time coming up with a name that I think is, I try to come up with names that are memorable, but that also have a deeper meaning that a lot of readers might not even get or understand or ever figure out. But to me, it's just very pleasurable to do that.
I tried to pride myself in knowing, you know, stuff about grapes and stuff, and I've talked to people and all that, and I didn't put together the correlations between the grapes and the names. So I will start looking for that now in your book.
There's so many varieties out there, isn't there? So there's actually a lot of great names out there. Like, there's an English grape variety. I think it's English. Norton. So Norton is going to be a character name eventually for one of my books, probably. There's a lot of great grape names out there. Not just Chardonnay, but a lot of good grape names you can use for different characters.
For names, this is such a list of great, great names. Yeah, I never thought of that.
Yeah, there's so many. Yeah. I mean, Italy has, what, 600 types of grape varieties?
Yeah. I mean, you never run out of character names that way.
No, exactly. No. Yeah, it would be a long time.
I never thought of that. No, very good. Your opinion, and this isn't about your book, but this is just something I was curious your opinion on, proliferation of wine in cans now and other types of containers as opposed to bottles.
Yeah, again, I think it's like synthetic wine. I think it's one of these things that to some people is going to appeal. It certainly has its time and place. I live in London, England right now, and I went to a theater production a little while ago to see a show, and the wine came in a can. and to drink drink wine in a theater, I mean, yeah, it kind of makes perfect sense. I mean, maybe in an airplane too, or if you pick something up at a gas station, definitely it could have its place. And we all know now that cork has anywhere between 3 to 5% failure rate in terms of cork taint, although it's improving greatly. But if you get wine in a can, it's going to taste exactly how the winemaker wants it to taste. And again, they're not going for a vintage Fleury or something. They're going for just basic wine that you drink and you enjoy quickly at the time. So I think canned wine has its place. It's not something I don't think you're going to ever see a sommelier in a good restaurant open a canned wine. But that said, we're now very used to Stelvin wine capsules, aren't we? I mean, there was a big argument years ago about Stelvin and about screw caps, and that's now very much accepted because it's not accepted. You don't think so?
No, I'm just saying, back when the Stelvin first came out, it was like, I'm not going to drink a wine that has a screw cap on it. What's wrong with, and now it's,
But a lot of wines these days, and even Bordeaux now, a lot of wines these days are made to be drunk, ready to drink. They're made to be drunk right away, not age for years. And rosés being a very good example of that. Rosé is not made to age. It's meant to be drunk within 3 or 4 years of production, if not a year or two of production. And what better way to preserve it than with a Stelvin screw cap that's going to really preserve the fresh aromatic tastes and flavors in there.
Right. And you're seeing it more and more. So, maybe one day we'll sit down at some very fancy restaurant and somebody will come up and pop the top on a can of wine and pour it into your glass.
Well, I'll watch you from afar doing that. I won't be in that restaurant. No, like I said, I think it's got its time and place, and I think a fancy restaurant with a sommelier, I don't think that would fly.
I don't think that would work either. The mental picture is great, though.
Oh, it's kind of horrifying, isn't it? Can you imagine? I think just for fun, just if you did that, like just for laughs or something, some kind of skit for comedy, that'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it would be.
I don't think the traditional wine world is at risk at all from synthetic wine, from canned wine, from Stelvin screw caps. There's a place for both. There's a place for traditional wine and a purist, and there's a place for the bottom shelf and the fresh aromatic wines you made in cans or Stelvin screw cap bottles or in boxes. Cardboard, as they're calling it, I guess.
Cardboard, yeah, I hadn't heard that. That's good.
There's so many great terms out there. I'm trying to get them all into my books eventually.
The sad thing is you write it into the book and it's so easy to read right over it, not catch the
true
the full impact of it.
Yeah, true. So it is,
Jupiter's Blood has been out how long?
It came out on May 1st, so it's been out for a few months now. And so far, I'm not going to retire anytime soon, sadly, off my book sales. But those people who are reading it have really enjoyed it. I've had very, very little negative feedback, and very, very only a couple people pointing out a couple minor things here and there that they didn't think were consistent or they didn't like. But overall, 98% of the readers and the feedback I've gotten is very positive, so which is really encouraging, I must say. This, like I said, is my third wine novel now, and people really seem to enjoy them. And people who have read one or two or three of them are all looking forward to the next one or want to read the others. So that's really, really encouraging. I mean, if I was writing these books and just getting completely negative feedback, I would have stopped a long time ago. But I'll keep on writing while people enjoy them because I enjoy the process.
You mentioned something there that just caught my attention. Do people actually read your books and look for little things that are wrong?
It takes all sorts. I mean, most people are pretty positive and just get on with it. I mean, I read a lot. I read very widely, and I love reading. Like, for instance, like Stephen King is a favorite author of mine because he just writes so well. I mean, believe it or not. And I'll pick up typos in books printed by Pan Macmillan and, I mean, all the big producers. It's I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it's very, very difficult to print a book with zero mistakes or zero inconsistencies. But I just read over them. You don't bother. But it is funny how some people will really nitpick little tiny things here and there. And I think – and sometimes that's all they say. They don't say anything else about the other 99,999 words. They just pick the one word that they –
That's hilarious. Oh, what happened?
Looks like he dropped. Looks like
he dropped
the connection.
All
here.
Disappeared. Yeah, look at that.
You got to listen when it says, you know, put another quarter or a dime, whatever it is.
put a dime in the slot.
In the machine to continue the call.
Yeah. I wonder if he knows it.
You know, 5 minutes.
I wonder if he knows that he's dropped.
Yeah, if he hears a little beeps, for the disconnect, it might make sense.
Is he calling
to him,
from London?
I don't know. That was a there it
there
is.
He is.
He's back
on
now. Okay. Woohoo! All right.
Yeah.
Got him on.
You
hi, Ron.
Ran,
sorry, I think we
you ran away from us.
Yeah. Cut off exactly 1 hour, so not sure what happened there.
Okay. I was thinking that. I looked at the time and I thought maybe it timed out on you. Are you calling from London?
I am, yes, yeah. London, England, yes.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm based here now.
Oh, wow. Well, you're like 6 hours ahead of us, aren't you?
5. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning here.
Oh, wow. Oh, I didn't realize you were going to be calling from over there. We could have arranged something so you wouldn't have to be calling that late. Oh, wow.
No worries. I'm often up late, often up early. So, I'm taking a bit of a career break right now, taking a year off to focus on the wine novel, focus on my WSET diploma, do some traveling to wine regions. So it's great to have the time off so I can do this no problem.
Oh, okay. London, England, we tried to talk to a champagne maker from England, and we got disconnected and could never make a new connection with him. But the champagne the champagne
production
field, yes, in England.
Yeah.
Tell us about it. What
do
you know about
it? It's booming. It's really booming. I mean, you think about it, France and England at one point were connected and then they split, of course, over time, and the English Channel developed in between them. So the soil, the chalk soil, exists very much so in the – if you look at the cliffs of Dover, for instance, it's all chalk. So the limestone and chalk is very much prevalent in southern England, in Kent and Ashford and Sussex. So there's a lot of excitement down there in terms of producing wine, and that's only an hour or a couple of hours outside of London. So you've got great producers like Balfour, Gus Bourne, Nye Timber, Chapel Down, doing great things, and a lot of them are supported or even benefit from sponsorship from big champagne companies like Moët & Chandon and Tattinger, who appreciate and understand that this is going to be a big market in the future because the climate is perfect for producing Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. What the biggest challenge right now in terms of English sparkling wine is the vintage variation and the sheer lack of reserve wines. So it's part of the reason why English sparkling wine, surprisingly, is quite expensive, because they just can't make enough of it. And there will be some years where they won't have a vintage at all. So they've got to charge a higher price. You'll be buying sparkling wine for the same price as some non-vintage champagne, which seems a bit surprising. But the quality is quite high as well, so it's not terribly surprising either. But it's just going to get better and better in terms of wine production. And there's some great rosés coming out of southern England, too. So, it's really booming. And they're set up for tourism, and there's restaurants in these wineries. So it's a beautiful market.
Wow. Now, this was, I don't know, a year and a half ago, I think, something like that. We tried to connect with them, and we could not get connected. That's why I'm surprised that you're calling from London and, you know, through so clearly today, you know.
Technology is pretty straightforward out here.
Yeah, really. Look at we have trouble with Blog Talk Radio. We've had our issues with Blog Talk Radio and used other means to get connected. And I'm surprised when you mentioned London earlier and confirmed it. I was surprised that you came right in, and we've had no issues with it or anything. So that's good for Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Mike, any comments or anything?
Just another thought.
No, go on.
Pardon me?
Go on.
I was going to say, just while we're talking about England and London, one of the great things about living in London and working in London is because previously and traditionally, London has not had its own wine industry, and it's got such a rich history of trading with France and Portugal and Spain and Italy. So if you go to a wine store in England, in London generally, you've got such a great array of wines without a bias towards any particular country. Whereas if you're in France, most of the wines on the shelf are going to be French. If you're in Spain, Spanish, Italy, Italian, of course, right? But in London, in England, in America, you're going to get mostly American wines. And of course, people are going to sell their own wines. But England doesn't have that bias and that historical wine tradition to worry about. So it's very democratic here in terms of the wines you can get, in terms of the sheer variety of wines too. So I can get anything from any country around the world in terms of wine here in London. So that's one great thing about the wine industry, or the wine retail market anyways, in London.
Did the prices go up when they broke away from the EU?
Yes. It was the Brexit. That really had an impact on a lot of pricing throughout everything, essentially. And then combined with inflation and post-COVID world and a shipping crisis, I think the cost of living crisis has really impacted a lot of people. But in terms of prices of wine increasing, that's still very much a first world problem, isn't it? I mean, if you can't afford an expensive wine. But the price of your Bordeaux has gone up a little bit. Nobody's crying for you, unfortunately.
yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
But we have seen the prices go up, yes.
Yeah, I was following the breakup, and the main thing I was following about the breakup was what it was going to do to the wine industry. I mean, they were talking not just England, but it would have ripple effects around the world, actually. And I just wondered how much they broke free in this. That was the end of it. You didn't hear anything else about how the prices might have been affected. So,
it's one of those things, I think, yeah, I mean, the big news was the breakup, but then, of course, there's so much repercussions of that, and there's a lot that we don't even know about, and we're still going to be feeling the ramifications for years as well. One of the best descriptions I heard of Brexit was, it's like trying to unbake a cake. I mean, trying to disentangle one country from the European Union. It's not just like you close the door. There's so many laws and rules and regulations, and I mean shipping and imports and exports and the forms you got to fill in and the taxes, and it's not a simple thing. So the fact that they did it is still a mystery and a disappointment to a lot of people, I think, and it's something that eventually, the long term, there's going to be a big sense of regret. And it'll be interesting to see if they ever decide to go back, which, of course, will raise a lot of eyebrows in the EU.
yeah, I can imagine. Well, it's like trying to unstrand one strand of a spider web and have it.
Exactly,
on
its own. Or trying to break down a wine and make a synthetic version.
Yes. Just something like that. the Brexit is still, I think, surprising people all over the place, understanding how and why. And
it's going to have long-term ramifications for a long time. A lot of major companies are now relocating headquarters or offices or production to different countries that are a little more stable or a little more connected. Yeah, and I was just reading a little while ago, GlaxoSmithKline, for instance, is moving 20,000 people to Poland. There's going to be a lot of long-term ramifications. There's already been a lot of impact, but there'll continue to be more and more impact. Because it's easier to work in a friction-free environment. And if you're working in the EU, if you're a student and you want to study, if you're living in Italy and you want to study in Spain, it's friction-free. But now, if you're living in England and want to study in Europe, there's a lot more to get your head around. And even just traveling, now you've got to get a visa for different places. There's going to be more fees to travel, much more checking of documents for English people to travel. So, yeah, it's got real-world implications, and that would certainly spill over into the wine industry and retail there.
And that's what I was following, that it would costs more just to pay the fees from one country to the other.
Yeah, duties and imports for sure. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
It makes a big difference. Mike, any questions for Stephen here tonight?
It's
Hi, Mike.
Probably a two-part. Hey. I kind of sit in the background, take notes. Okay, it's kind of a two-parter real quick. Where can people buy your book or your books? Where can they purchase them? And you said you're writing a new book, Heist Bordeaux. When do you project that to be released?
So answer the first question, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, I mean, any of the online booksellers, you can find my book, so it's pretty straightforward, and all the books are available. So my very first book is a book called Lethal Suggestions, that's a psychological thriller, and then the next three are wine books, so Root Cause, Dragon Vine, and Jupiter's Blood. They could be read in that order, but they don't necessarily need to be, it's not a series, so if readers want to read Jupiter's Blood and then go back to Dragon Vine and Root Cause, that's absolutely fine. But yeah, it's available on any online bookstores right now. In terms of Heist Bordeaux, I've done the outline. I'm probably written about 15 draft chapters, and I'm part of a critique group, so of writers around the world, where we get together each month on Zoom and critique each other's work. And so they're currently reading my work. But in terms of publication date, it'll be probably late 2025 for Heist Bordeaux. And that's just a working title right now, so it might change.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you.
So everybody will be out there looking for a Heist Bordeaux and they won't be able to find it.
Well, I'll be putting it on my social media and it's not available now anyways, but it'll be available next year. And I've got a great publicist out in California. So she does a lot of work in terms of promoting the book and publicizing the book and getting the name out there. And hopefully we'll talk again to talk about that next book.
I'm already looking forward to it. Yes. Give us your contact information. If anyone wants to get in touch with you, if anyone wants to criticize you.
Criticize you, sure, yeah. So it's ronhunt.com. So I've got a I've got a website. It's StephenLane.com. So Stephen with a V, LAINE.com. And on there's a contact form, so people can reach me through my website. I've got a Facebook profile, Stephen Lane. I've got a LinkedIn profile, obviously, and I've got Instagram, and the Instagram is Stephen.Lane as well. So everything's under my name. I'm pretty easy to find on social media. I always respond to readers and people with questions as much as possible while I still can. So yeah, and always happy to hear from people who read the book and engage with people and talk about wine and writing.
Very good. All right. It's refreshing to hear someone who writes a book that's willing to come out there and discuss the book and talk about the book with people who read it. I think that's fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. I want to do a lot more of it in future. I just find it so engaging. And like I said, if I'm excited about what I'm writing, then I'd like to think that the readers will be excited by what they're reading. So that's where I get a lot of my ideas, my inspiration. And so far it seems to be hitting a nerve and people are resonating with that.
Yeah. I loved both the books I've read so far, and I will pick up your first book and add that to my repertoire.
Yeah, and any feedback you have, please let me know as well. You got my details. You know, you drop me a line directly. If you have any feedback or any criticism, please feel free to drop me a line. I've developed a pretty thick skin. I think as anybody who's creating creative content and putting it out there for the world to read or see or experience, you've got to develop a thick skin. So I do take feedback seriously. I think if somebody's giving you feedback, it's worth its weight in gold. And if you do hear the same thing again and again, for instance, then you've really got to look at it and say, okay, something's going on here. I need to fix this, or I need to understand why people are interpreting it in such a way. So I don't look at feedback negatively. And I don't think, I think readers are smart, and I like to get their feedback and understand, what my reading means to them and how they interpret it.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I mean, anytime you get out there and you're dealing with the public, there's people that find things that are not to their liking, and they will let you know. And
yeah, and
you
that's
do
fine.
Have,
and if people are, sorry.
Yeah, I'll just say you do have to develop that thick skin, because some people with the anonymity of everything now tend to spout off more than they normally would. So
True. Yeah. And if somebody just says, oh, I hated the book, then I don't think too much about that because that's not specific. But if somebody says, I didn't like this character because of this, then that's something I can work with. I can look at that and think, okay, do they have a point? Is that valid? Why would they think that? And then I can look at that in a little more depth and figure out how to approach that next time or understand what they're trying to say.
Yeah, very good. There you go. Fantastic. Well, Jupiter's Blood, I just finished it. I finished it about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Fantastic book, as was the Dragonvine that I read. And I'm looking forward to picking up that first one and reading that. And having you back on the show in a year and a half, whenever your next book comes out. And we'll talk about that and other odd and different things that we happen to bring up.
we've barely scratched the surface, and I think there's still a lot more to talk about in terms of wine, in terms of writing, and I really look forward to talking to you again, Ron. And Mike, it's been great to be on the show, and I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, Stephen. I really do. I enjoy talking with you and reading your books and all that, and I will look forward to our next discussion.
Fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, we'll have a wonderful night. And again, thanks for your time.
You
I look forward to hearing the podcast come out and, hopefully engaging more readers.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for staying up late with us.
Yes.
No worries.
Yeah. Have a good night.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank
good night.
Good night.
Thank
cheers.
You too.
Bye.
All right.
He's dropped the second time.
Always enjoy talking with him. He's very knowledgeable, but is always enjoyable. First time we talked with him, I really liked it. This time it's just as enjoyable. Looking forward to his next book too. He does a great job. But have you had an opportunity to read Dragonvine yet?
No. Let me see. How long has that been out? That's been for a while now.
Over a year. Year and a half. I sent you
the
book.
Did you? Okay, yeah. Let me take a look here because I might have gotten these stupid emails I get.
I sent you a hard copy.
Okay. I got to take a look. I'll take a look. I think it's over on my side table. I'm sure I still have it. I'll have to take a look because I had to redo some things moving the. It's been a while, but yeah, I had to. I'm sure it's in here. Yeah.
Yeah. It's.
I forgot it was. First thing I think of is electronic, and because I know you sent a couple of things over electronic, and I was like, oh, maybe it was electronic. No, but I do remember you sending it in the envelope and everything, the big envelope. So I got to take
hard
a look.
Hard copy of it. Yeah. Yeah. Get a chance to read that.
Yeah. It sounds interesting. Cool.
Probably get hooked on his style just like I did. And it'd be interesting to discuss with you, too, because he talked about different things in the books that I'm familiar with because I've been in wine for a number of years, and I have knowledge in different areas of wine, whereas you haven't been in it that long, so your knowledge isn't as strong. So it'd be interesting after you read it to see what your take is on it as opposed to mine.
I'll pick it up. It's only been a year. Wow.
I think it's been about a year.
Where have I been?
working hard.
I don't know. Because it wasn't around the hurricane time, was it? No, I don't remember. God, that was such a messed up time. But I have to check. But yeah, I know it's in here.
I don't know. I don't recall. I have trouble recalling last week. You know. All right.
All right.
We do have a guest next week.
You're good. Okay.
I am delaying a moment here to dig out the calendar and see who it is. September.
Uh,
Oxley Graham is our guest next week.
Ooh.
Oxley? O-X-L-E-E Graham, G-R-A-H-A-M. Let me see if I can't find Oxley and tell you a little bit more.
It's a boutique winery. Oxley Graham Wines.
Yeah. Okay, let me expand this. And there we go. I'm Oxley Graham, a small winery in Sonoma. And Jeannie is the founder, and it's she says in an underrepresented as an underrepresented woman winemaker. So that's good. I always like to give women as much credit as I can because they're really doing a great job. She says if Burgundy in California had a baby, it would be Oxley Graham. So it's a stretch of, says each label is a tribute and homage to strong women that shaped and inspired her life. So Jeannie looks like she'll be the one that will be talking with us from the winery Oxley Graham. So she's scheduled for next week. So
okay.
There we go.
Very cool.
Out of Sonoma.
Right. We'll plan for that one. Yep. All right. So we'll expect that next Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, live here on Blog Talk Radio and social media and every place else. And 12. Okay. Any last minute things to add? It is 8:21 p.m. here.
Oh, is it? Oh, wow.
Florida.
Yeah, and it's 18 here on this side of Florida, so we're further
west.
Yeah,
well, you're further west. Yeah, it's later here by a couple minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. However that works. We'll talk to you all next Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for tuning in, as always, either live or on the archives. And have a great weekend ahead, and have a great week. Thank you for tuning in. Good night. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for listening. Be safe.
Thank you. Let's see if that started up. It did. Oh, hang on. You can't hear it again.
You're right. You're right.
Ron, for share information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
There we go.
All right.
All right. I'm going to stop this one. All right. Cool. And the green room.